and welcome to the Pocket Gamer Podcast. It's episode number 474. My name is James Gilmore. Joining me today is Rick Cowley.
Hello.
Back for another chat about the mobile and indeed Switch gaming world. I am going to have to apologize in advance for what you may be able to hear in the background. The pouring rain that's going on just outside my window. Because the universe knew I was going to try and record something with decent mic quality. So it thought, nah, background noise. Sploosh!
Could be worse. I'm pretty certain the people next door to me are having a bit of afternoon delight.
Oh, so. My God! We've just qualified for Apple's explicit tag.
Hopefully you won't be able to hear it, and hopefully they didn't hear me say that, but...
Goodness me. Well, stay tuned to this episode. It promises to be a rip-roaring adventure. World of mobile games and daytime copulation. So, what have we got for you today? We're going to be talking about streaming, the future of mobile gaming being pushed through your Wi-Fi or by then 5G, perhaps even 6G signals and into your phones. This is chatter from both Apple and Microsoft about the way you're going to be consuming your mobile games in future. Also, we have got new releases, including the likes of The Stillness of the Wind, The Horns, some Switch titles, including the likes of Riot, Civil Unrest, Away, The Journey to the Unexpected, and more. But first, the news. It's fair to say that subscription services as a whole have kind of dominated the modern media landscape. I grew up in a time when there were VHSs and then DVDs and then Blu-rays, but that time has long since passed now, with the Netflix and Spotify models pretty much destroying traditional media in favor of just having everything you want at the click of a button and a slurp on an internet cable. And there's a good chance that your mobile gaming experience is going to go the same way at some point in the future. We're looking at two rumors today. First one, Apple is reportedly looking at a Netflix-style subscription service for the App Store. With this, I don't know whether they are talking about streaming these games or whether they just mean you subscribe to the service and then that gives you access to download the games.
I can't tell either, to be honest, but I would assume it's streaming.
You reckon it's streaming?
Yeah, because streaming's already being done on mobile as well.
That's true.
Is it Hatch?
Hatch is the name, yeah.
That's the one, on Android, yeah.
You can already actually sign up for that if you want to. We've mentioned it on the podcast before, but look for the Hatch app over on the Google Play Store, and it's kind of in a beta phase right now, but you can basically get access to a bunch of like surprisingly good games, things like Monument Valley and whatnot. And you just sign up for it and you stream the games as you would stream anything else. And I tested it for a while, actually. Works surprisingly well. I mean, goes without saying you need to make sure your connection is good, because that's how all these things work. But no, it genuinely did work and you didn't experience huge amounts of latency or anything like that. I was quite impressed.
Cool.
We should say in advance, this is very much a rumor. It's been reported by an outlet called Cheddar, which neither you nor I have heard of before. And their source is, quote, 5 people familiar with the matter, which is spectacularly vague. But that doesn't mean it's not true. Equally, take it with a pinch of salt. But the thing is, it has the ring of truth about it. Because anyone who's been sort of looking at the industry over the past few years or had any contact with the mobile gaming space or the gaming space in general, you can see the seeds of this being sown. Right back as far as OnLive, which we've talked about before, the 2011 service, which was like, we're going to stream games and you can test it. And the internet just wasn't up to the task, but the idea was sound. And then forward to things like PlayStation Now, which currently work as a full live streaming service. And then Xbox Game Pass, which downloads, but it's still a subscription model. Then you've got Hatch popping up doing the same thing. And the fact is, more and more people don't really want to pay at the point of service for games, which is why the free-to-play thing happened in the way that it did, because people don't like the idea of not being able to play immediately. They're much more comfortable with the idea of, we'll pay some money after the fact. And subscription models kind of counterbalance that by going, well, we're going to get you to pay before you've tried any of these things, but then it's just going to be a subscription, so it kind of sneaks out of your bank account in the middle of the night every month, and you kind of forget about it, and it starts feeling free.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that feels like the psychology of subscription stuff to me, whereby it, like, it just becomes one of the daily expense things that you factor in, and it gets pushed into that bit of money in your head, which is like, this is just general outgoings.
Yeah.
And it kind of becomes invisible.
Yeah, I am the same way with Netflix, actually. When I'm doing my monthly budgets, it is just part of my monthly outgoing thing. It's just paying for Netflix. It's just a part of my life now.
And when a kind of nice movie or a movie you want to see pops up on there, or a new show, you have that thing of like, ooh, like free show.
Yeah.
And it's not at all free.
It hasn't been free for the past 3 years, but I'm still paying.
No, but your brain kind of makes you feel that way. And of course, this is what they call like disruption in the industry. Again, it's another one of those horrible buzzwords. I apologize. But that's what Netflix did. It was a disruptive tech that basically broke the traditional model. Ergo, no one's buying CDs anymore. No one's renting Blu-rays. Blockbuster went out of business. All those services went out of business because of, hey, just click the thing. Click the thing and then it's on your TV. And that's it. And there is every chance that all the big lot, I imagine Google Play is looking into this as well. I can tell you that Google themselves were trialing that streaming service which lets you play console quality games in browser. Remember that Assassin's Creed thing?
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah. So you just literally open a browser, go in, and you're playing Assassin's Creed via a streaming service in the same way you're playing PlayStation Now. Everyone's looking into this. And I think it's fair to assume that Apple is doing the same. I think they'd be mad not to.
The thing that I question, although I haven't really thought this through properly. So maybe you can help me understand.
I like your raw, unvarnished thoughts.
It's like, why would Apple want to do this? Why would they want to steer people onto a subscription service model where they are making a finite amount of money per month per customer, when they are making infinitely more money from free-to-play gamers spending whatever they want and however often they want in-game?
Well, I'm wondering if they are hosting the subscription service themselves, and let's be fair, like the reason Hatch is being trialed on Google Play and not on Apple is because I'm pretty sure it wouldn't be allowed on the App Store. Like, Apple gatekeep this stuff incredibly aggressively. So what I'm thinking is that if Apple set up a service like this, where they're pushing X number of games onto everybody's phones for, inverted commas, free, but it's not, it's a subscription every month, then maybe A, they get a better cut of it. B, you're monetizing customers who perhaps aren't keen on doing the whole free-to-play in-app payment thing. Because remember, though there is a huge audience of people who do use free-to-play in-app purchases, and, you know, that's where all this massive industry comes from. This is why everybody's moving to free-to-play, because it makes, you know, billions. But saying that, it's still only 2-3% of the audience who plays a game which pays that.
Yeah, true.
And some people just aren't into in-app purchases, whereas people seem to be pretty comfortable playing subscriptions.
Mm.
And, you know, I don't buy in-app purchases, really. That's not a thing that I do. I'm not particularly comfortable with it in the format of a game. I like to just pay for the thing, play the game, not have to worry about whether they've made things artificially difficult or grindy in order to get more money out of me in the long term.
Yep.
I don't want to have to do that calculation. However, I am subscribed to Spotify. I am subscribed to Netflix. I am subscribed to Amazon. Like, I'm happy to pay money in that sense. And to be honest with you, if there is a subscription service where they're like, hey, here's access to all these games and every month X number of games will be added to it for a flat fee and they will all be premium and there will be no in-app purchases, that is more attractive to me personally.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
I might be in the minority, but I get the feeling that there are a bunch of people who, you know, it's just we don't want to worry about these individual payments. Just charge us the £5 or the £10 and we'll forget about it and carry on playing till we're dead. And then you'll have milked us dry for thousands over the course of our lifetime. Job done.
The other thing that I question as well is because Amazon used to do this, and it was like a free, you play premium games for free through the Amazon App Store, and it was Amazon Underground.
That's it, yeah.
Which has been discontinued this year because nobody used it. Now, obviously, the main thing there is nobody used the Amazon App Store in general. It was a tiny App Store when you think about it. But the other thing was that developers were getting sort of like 0.0025 pence per player per hour or something.
That is the problem.
It was a ridiculously low amount of money per person playing the game. So it turned out some developers kind of came out in support of it and said, oh yeah, we're actually making decent money off this. I think Rovio said something about making good money off it. But other developers kind of didn't see any return. So it's a question of how are Apple going to pay the developers who agreed to sign up to the subscription service? But again, I guess that's the trouble that you have with all subscription services, which is like Netflix and stuff. Everyone's only paying about £8 a month and they've got thousands of different licenses that they need to pay and stuff like that. So I'm sure they're thinking about it, but it's just in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, what is it going to be a good deal for developers who could potentially make more money just selling the game?
Well, probably not, which makes it a good deal for Apple, which is more to the point of why they would want to do it. Because that's been the thing with Spotify, isn't it? Which is that everyone always complains that the amount of money that you get per play, per click on Spotify, if you like, is minuscule. So if you're an artist, you get paid like, you know, 50p for someone playing a song 1,000 times. It's like, not exact figures, but it's a ridiculously low amount of money when you look at how many times it's being streamed, which is indicative of, well, bad deal for developers. So where's the money going? It's probably going to Spotify. Yeah. Which would, you know, and that means maybe Apple would like a piece of that. Even if the developers aren't getting as much, they're probably, some of them will probably say yes as just something to supplement. And then Apple gets a sweeter cut and Apple is happy and continues to be rich. Maybe, I don't know. But this is, as I say, rumor stuff. This isn't confirmed, but it just like has the ring of truth. Which also dovetails into Xbox and their plans. Xbox Live might be coming to mobile and Switch. So this is Xbox Live, the service or the thing that gives you access to your Xbox Live account, right?
Mm-hmm. This is stuff like friends and achievements and that kind of thing. It's not not going online and playing against other people because that's already free on mobile and Nintendo has its own service. This is specifically just the Xbox Live service being able to access it from other devices and implement it in games, I think is the key thing.
So this is something, I think Windows Central put this bit of news out, but they're going to be talking at this year's GDC about the SDK, which is the little development kit basically that you give to developers and say, put this in your game and it will integrate whatever. And in this case, integrate Xbox Live across iOS, Android and Switch. Which, as you point out in your story, it's already been done before with Minecraft.
Mm-hmm.
So if you play Minecraft on the Switch, you can like dive in and look at your achievements on Xbox, despite the fact that you're on a Switch.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, because Microsoft owns Minecraft and made sure that every single version of Minecraft, you now have to log into your Xbox Live account to be able to play it.
Mm. So if they have access to that network, that framework, doesn't this open the door to cross-platform stuff?
I don't know. They're sort of suggesting that it will, but I don't know how that would work and why platform holders would be okay with it.
Because again, we do have some games which allow for cross-platform play, and I'm thinking specifically of Fortnite here, where you can play cross-platform. So it's happening a little bit more, and there's been a few barriers broken down. There was that whole thing of, it was PlayStation saying that now we're not letting cross-platform play happen. What was their quote about PlayStation is the best way to play Fortnite or whatever it was? And Microsoft, on the other hand, going, come on, PlayStation, go on, give us, we want to play with you lot because there's a lot more of you than there is of us. Let us in. Come on. It'll be nice. It'll be fun. But it came off looking quite bad from a PR perspective. The optics weren't great on that comment. And then later on, PlayStation kind of pulled a 180 and went, all right, actually, yeah, cross-platform play for everybody. So I think that's going to happen a little bit more. And the idea of, hey, could we play actual PlayStation games and stuff on our mobiles in Asia is like a bit misleading. And again, this is like the browser thing with what Google have been trying to do. It's all very well and good being able to stream an Xbox game, for example, onto your mobile. I did it. Again, going back to OnLive, I was playing, for example, Batman Arkham Asylum. I was streaming Batman Arkham Asylum onto my then Galaxy S2. And I was like, wow. And, you know, it starts up and it's working. It's streaming. And I'm connected to the Wi-Fi in my flat. And you're like, my God, this is amazing. And then you realize, like, I've got to control this somehow. And so you pull up a little map of controls and you suddenly realize there's a lot of buttons on the Xbox controller, isn't there? And you need to use all of them. And suddenly I can't see the game anymore underneath this mess of transparent hotkeys. I was like, oh. And then it started every like 5 seconds and the lag was horrible. And you go, this is actually a terrible idea. I don't want to play this on my mobile. I want to play this on a big TV with a controller because that's the kind of game that it is. So there was that problem. Now, I'm imagining that what will happen in the future is if this kind of thing becomes more prevalent, games will be developed with this in mind.
Yes.
So they will be scalable, if you like, onto different platforms. And there will be like, well, we've got to make sure this game also works on a touchscreen with a control set, maybe a simplified control set. And then you can also convert that to a physical controller or whatever.
God, that'd be nice. They would finally get some of the bigger games on Switch, if that was the case.
What do you think you're missing out on Switch, then?
Like Red Dead Redemption and stuff like that.
That's
really big games.
That's 100 gigabytes of stuff on the PlayStation 4. I mean, the streaming would solve that problem if it was a streaming service.
Yeah, true. They're already streaming Assassin's Creed Odyssey in Japan on Switch.
On Switch. That was the one that they were using for that Google trial as well.
Yeah. And they did Odyssey. It before with Resident Evil 7.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Which is the first one they did.
Just to test it out. And the question is how desirable this is to the average person. And if the infrastructure is in place to make it work, which has traditionally been the problem.
Mm.
Because streaming is a pain if you don't have a good internet connection. Streaming is fine until it's not.
Yeah.
Like, my internet went down catastrophically when I came back from Colombia over Christmas. So I came back home. And then within about 24 hours, my little home hub started flashing a colour it had never flashed before.
I love it when that happens.
I know, and I had to be like, what's this, purple? I've never seen purple. So I go to Google it, and then obviously I can't Google it because there's no internet. So I'm on the phone with the mobile data, you know, checking away. And that was the one saying that purple means the hub is fine, but the internet has vanished into a bush. I'm like, oh, damn. And it turned out there'd been some weird complete like disconnection. And it was at that moment, and I'm sure listeners have experienced this, everyone's experienced this, when you go, right, I've got no internet, and then you look around at what you've got, and you suddenly realise you don't have anything anymore.
Yeah.
I've got a substantial DVD collection that's back in my parents' attic because I did not bring it with me to the flat because I don't need it anymore. Until you do need it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. And it's the same with all these connectivity things. The moment it drops away and you're left with just you, you're like, actually, I mean, luckily I do have a bunch of Blu-rays and stuff because I get stuff I really like.
Mm.
For A, it's a better bit rate and it's better sound quality. And B, I just still like having some things on the shelf. That's quite a nice thing for me. But there is that sensation of just like the intangibility of it all really hits home. And I don't know, with stuff like this, with games, how willing people are at this point to let go of their consoles, to let go of that physical thing on which they store their stuff. Because I think more than anything, like Spotify has been just a complete smash in the face for CDs, physical media. The things that are selling now are records.
Yeah.
So there's been this resurgence because now they have to sell it in a completely different way. You're not selling it because you'd buy a CD in the past because the CD was the only way to get the album.
Mm-hmm.
That was the primary media. Whereas now, you buy a record, they're selling records again because they have to target it at collectors.
Yeah.
You have to target a completely different market. Now, they're selling physical media not just so you can have access to it. They're only selling it to the extremely high-end mediaphile types who are in it for the authentic, you know, cut groove, pure analog sound and the big collector's edition case and all that. Like, people... Otherwise, you just stream it. Like...
And when you do buy vinyls these days and records and stuff, it comes with a digital download.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you still get the good like portable variant of it, but you've also got the big collectible thing. It's the same with Blu-rays as well. They usually do like you'll find in the case there's a downloadable version of the movie.
There's the digital UV code, yeah.
Yeah.
But again, I think the alternatives will start to kick in, and that kind of content, the 4K, incredibly high bitrate definition, and the same thing with things like VR that I've been playing a lot of at the minute, will cater to the niche crowd who crave the super high end,
mm-hmm.
while the majority of people will just stream a thing or sign up to a service and play the basic stuff in that way that people just want to play something to relax at the end of the day. And that's going to become the big gaming audience. And then the people who really do care about whether 4K is native or whether they've done cross-hatched upscaling from a lower resolution, those people will become the super niche.
Yeah.
The connoisseurs, if you like.
God. As if we don't have enough divides in gaming already. We're now going to have the gaming snobs.
Which is true, but at the same time, like, if you can just get it through Google Browser, this is the ultimate way to get it into everybody's hands.
Yeah.
Whether they've, you know, spent £300 on a console or not. This is a way for just, like, anyone with a browser and a very basic PC, for example, or a very basic phone, just to get access to higher-end experiences they wouldn't have been able to play otherwise, provided the internet's okay. That angle of it, I like.
Mm-hmm.
What worries me is the thing that you pointed out, which is how do you make money from it? And also, I think, and Mike Rose, who's now a game publisher himself, but used to be a Pocket Gamer alumni back in the day, used to write for us, and he had already written books about indie development, and his focus really is indie, and that's what he publishes now. He was talking about the same thing, which is subscription models are fine if you're Epic. And you've got Fortnite and you're streaming Fortnite and it's just like a little bit of extra money that you get in addition to all the in-app purchases everyone's playing or whatever it might be. But indie developers don't do well out of that kind of thing. Indie, like small indie bands don't do well out of Spotify because they're not getting enough numbers to make it a feasible income. So once games as a service or streaming subscriptions start taking over, what happens to the little indie games which only serve a very small audience when they're getting played like hundreds of times or thousands of times instead of hundreds of thousands or millions of times, and it's not generating enough money to sustain them, and so they just can't make games anymore and live?
Well, that was a depressing tail off to that discussion.
Swings and roundabouts, isn't it? This is the stuff that we're considering. I appreciate this is quite techie talk for a Friday afternoon.
Gotcha.
But This is what's fermenting in the news at the minute. There wasn't a great deal of like fun little silly stories this week. It's just like big media giants announcing potentially huge disruptive techs or rumored to announce them. Again, this is just chatter that's going on around. These are sources of people who say that they appear to be doing this. I'm pretty sure that this Xbox Live thing will happen. Mm-hmm. As for the Apple subscription store, whatever form it takes, I just think it is very likely that we're going to see stuff like this in the future. And, I think it's going to change the way that we all interact with the little thing in our pocket, what has the games on it. So look out for that.
Keep an eye out for the entire world you know changing in the blink of an eye.
Out and about this week, we're going to start with Switch. For a change, just to pick up the energy a little bit, because we've just gotten all introspective about the nature of game. So Away, Journey to the Unexpected came out on the Switch. You've done the review, Rick. What is this? I've got no clue.
It looks like it should be sort of a Skyrim-esque RPG, and that's actually how it was sold to me when I saw it at GDC last year.
The pigs do look a bit like that.
Yeah, but it's like all anime styled and colourful art, and it's this weird mix of like, you're a 3D character in a 3D world, but all the other characters and enemies are in like super detailed 2D. It looks gorgeous, and they do some really weird stuff with the character designs and stuff like that. And it's made by a team of like two people, with like one main creator and then a couple of freelancers, I think it is. So it's really interesting background, really interesting ideas. It turns out it's actually a roguelike, which is really weird.
Oh, I see.
And you go into this, you wander around these kind of hub worlds, and then you go into dungeons, and the dungeons are randomly generated. You fight enemies, you sort of gather experience in the background, but you don't level up in any way, and then you move on to the next level, and there's fights and stuff. And if you die, you have to go all the way back to the start. Mm. But when you die, your experience points get spent, so you can finally start upgrading, unlocking shortcuts to like speed up your way to the exit and finally get to the final boss and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then on your way, you can also pick up these friendship cubes, which are in the wilderness. And then when you pick up a friendship cube, you can talk to the NPCs. And if you say the right things, they'll come and join you and be part of your party.
Cubes of friendship?
Yep. Just weird old floating cubes, which everyone sees and goes, oh, you're my friend now. And then you can switch to them, but they've got a limited energy bar rather than a health bar, so you can only use them sort of a set amount of time and a number of attacks kind of thing. And whenever you use them, they have this really weird filter that goes over the screen, and they all see the world in different ways. So like, it makes it really hard to play as them. But they're like way more powerful than you will ever be because you can't level up at all. So all your attacks do one hit, one damage for the entire game.
I'm watching a little video thing and he just became a bat with his middle cut out.
Yeah.
And then the screen went all purple. Yeah. Also, I'm now obsessed with the idea of buying into the friendship cube economy. Sorry, go on.
So yeah, it's this kind of really weird, colourful, bright thing. It's actually... It kind of isn't good. It right. sounds on paper really good, and then you actually get to the combat, and because the characters are in 2D that you're fighting, and you're in a 3D space, it's hard to tell how far away they are. Your depth perception is screwed, basically. Right. Okay. And if you get too close to an enemy, you just instantly take damage. They don't, like, attack you, it's just proximity damage type thing.
Oh.
So you'll just take loads of damage, because you'll have enemies bumping into you, and you won't be able to tell that they are close enough to bump into you.
Mm.
And your like targeting reticule is tiny, this tiny, tiny little circle that doesn't change when you're like able to attack. It doesn't give you any indication that they are within range to hit them. So you just kind of have to randomly swing and hope that something lands. And then when you switch to a character that has a gun or a ranged attack or something, you have to try and aim this tiny reticule on these tiny faraway enemies that are all in 2D with tiny hitboxes. And it's just like, oh, this is so frustrating to play. But
it looks a butt.
But it's really lovely. It's weirdly gentle to walk around. Mainly the hub worlds are like bright and colourful, and there's no enemies in the hub worlds. They're all in the dungeons. So you can just sort of wander around, explore, pick up a few items, find a friendship cube, go to the shop, that kind of thing. And you can just have like a really peaceful time. It's not forcing you forwards in any way. It doesn't try and like say, oh, you've got to go to this dungeon. You've got to go do this, this, and this. Like you've only got a certain number of things you can do, but it never tells you that you have to go do them. You can just take it at your own pace kind of thing. And yeah, it's just kind of like the vibe of the whole world is really gentle and lovely.
It's such a weird clash of art styles.
Exactly.
The world, because it's a first-person perspective and you're wandering around the world, that looks like a Time Splitters or like a Perfect Dark,
yes.
where it's like not very high-res textures, sort of glowy, soft lighting, and it looks very cartoony. And then the sprites pop up and it's like they've been pulled out of like Skullgirls or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Those really swish animated anime.
Mm.
Very, and they track you in that way that if you strafe around a Doom character in the original Doom kids, because they are just 2D sprites that just are always facing you no matter where you turn, and it does that. So it's very strange.
Yeah, it's a really weird mix of things, and it like that doesn't get old to look at either, because it's always strange to see, and your mind never really gets used to it. So that kind of thing it's really interesting in that way, but the combat itself kind of sucks. It's the main problem. And obviously, it's a game mostly about combat. And I feel like the progression as well is really broken in its own way. Because, like I say, you can't level up unless you die. Mm-hmm. And if you never die, you will never unlock the ability to block, which is really weird. And you don't get the ability to block until level 4.
Okay.
So you've got to die a whole bunch of times before you can even learn how to block attacks. By which point, you've already learned that dodging is basically the best way to do things. And you're getting quite far into the game, so you don't need to block at that point because you're so used to not blocking.
That reminds me of, I played the beginning of Bloodborne, right?
Yeah.
And when you walk out of the room at the very beginning of Bloodborne, you encounter like a big sort of blood-starved beast-looking werewolf thingy. And the idea is it kills you, and then you get taken back to their hub world, where you then get access to a bunch of stuff. I like managed to kill that beast thing. And then I spent the next like hour or two like skulking around the world, like trying to avoid being hit and like wondering what I was supposed to be doing and why I didn't have access to anything. And I was just trying to punch my way through Bloodborne until I died and went, oops. So it is weird having that thing where, as you say, you need to die in order to progress, but sometimes you don't know that.
Yeah.
So you're just trying to survive and you realize you should have just like jumped off a cliff and let the game begin.
Yeah, it's that unusual kind of thing. It's a bit frustrating at times, but it's an enjoyable game. I gave it a 7 out of 10 in my review, which you can check out on the website. But yeah, it's interesting. I love the art style. I don't really like the combat. You know, take from that what you will.
Fair enough. All right, then. So that is called Away, Journey to the Unexpected, and that's out on the Switch in a minute. So not a lot out on mobile, iOS or Android this week of particular interest. But there are a couple of things. The first being The Stillness of the Wind. What is it with these big, long, Away, Journey to the Unexpected, followed by The Stillness of the Wind? which is as indie and noodly as it sounds. That stuff we were talking about in the news, this is one of the games that probably wouldn't make a lot of money. Because not a great deal happens, but that's okay. So this is a game which opens on a farm, a kind of farm in the middle of what looks like a sort of desert area in maybe North America somewhere. I'm thinking Arizona. I don't know if Arizona is in North America.
It is.
Well, it's in North America, but I'm thinking now North or South, the South being... Texas. I'm just confusing myself.
I think it's in the west. So, I don't know.
Yeah. So it opens on this farm and it's nighttime and it very slowly turns to dawn and it's very beautiful. Those pastel indie shades you're used to, and the camera just sort of cranes up and then pushes in on this farm. And as it goes closer and closer, the door opens and out of the farm shambles an old woman. It's drawn in very, very simplistic. It looks like the characters from Journey and Monument Valley. So very, very low poly, simple style. And that's it. She just appears. And then you tap the screen somewhere because it's a mobile game and you think you should. And she starts to move. She wanders towards wherever you tap. And you go from there. There's no instruction. You just start like interacting with objects. And there's an outhouse. And you discover that there is a pot in the outhouse, which it says you can fill with milk if you want to. And so you go back outside and you realize that there's a paddock with some goats over there in the other side of the screen. So you mooch over to that. And you notice there's a bucket, a pail on the floor. So you pick up the bucket and move over to the goats. And then she will start to milk the goats, which you kind of tap every few seconds in order to perform that action till the bucket's full. And if you trundle back inside, pour the bucket in, push the stove onto to the fire, and then tap the fireplace, it will come to life. And then that, the idea is that process will allow you to make cheese, which you can then put on your shelf. You'll see that there are some chickens wandering about, and then you'll realize one of the places is a chicken coop. And if you wander over to there and try and get the eggs, you can't until you realize that there's a basket lying around somewhere. So go grab the basket, and then you collect the eggs. And now you have cheese and eggs. And you're like, why? What's going on? Like, why am I doing this? What's the point of all this then? And the answer is, there kind of isn't one. But it's not really about how much stuff can I accrue or how many eggs can I get or anything like that. What it comes down to is this narrative that's sitting in the background of it all. So when you go into the main house, you discover there are some letters. And you can read them. And it's letters from your relatives. And occasionally, after the first couple of days, because there's a day-night cycle in this, it suddenly goes dark, and you go, huh, and so you wander inside, and, you know, tap on the bed, and she goes to sleep, and then you wake up again, and it's dawn. And when you come outside after a couple of nights, there's a dude standing by the gate, waiting for you. And so you go over to him and talk to him, and he's the postman, basically, and he's delivering more letters, and he's also got stuff that you can trade with him. So you suddenly realize, the cheese and the eggs that I've collected, I can now trade these for things like hay, which I need to feed my goats, or seeds, because I can actually dig up the ground, I can till the earth, there's a hoe leaning against the side of the house. And if you go over there and start tapping in bits of the ground, you can dig it and then plant seeds. And then you need to water those seeds and you discover there's a well outside the house. So it's got this almost like Stardew Valley thing going on where it's just like you've got a farm and you're maintaining it. But it's not like where you're trying to expand the farm and have the biggest farm. And that's not it at all. What it is the story that's going on behind it through these letters. And it puts into context where you are and what's happened to the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to say any more than that because that's kind of what it's about. And it is an incredibly chill, contemplative thing where you get these little interaction moments between people and even little moments from the main character, the grandma herself, which give you these unexpected like bursts of, oh, or make you smile or something. And it's all in the way that she moves. She moves very slowly. She's stooped over. She's kind of in a shawl. When she sits down, she does a kind of really slow... you know, sitting down into a chair. And the environment itself looks old and worn. And the whole feeling about the game is just this kind of sense of time. The whole thing feels incredibly lived in.
Mm.
And then the information you get from the letter starts to fill in the backstory and the whys and the wherefores of it. This is going to be one of these things that some people are going to download and then immediately get furious about. Where's the game? What is this? this is bullshit. Like, I guarantee you that that will happen. But those of us who enjoy the noodly indie stuff, I think this does fall the right side of being incredibly pretentious. I, you know, some of these games, they straddle the line where it tips over from being genius to just like, oh, come on. Like, what are you, what is there? What are you trying to do with this?
Mm.
But this one really does invoke a feeling. Like, I've been playing it this morning to capture it for the review, and I kind of wanted to have a little sleep afterwards. A nice little cozy nap. That's the feeling of it.
Yeah.
And that might be something that you, well, that is something you don't get from a lot of games, which are often about hype and getting your adrenaline spiking and all of that. And people who are looking for that will not find it here, but I think this is an interesting one. This is one of these like quiet, emotive, chill Zen experiences. And I do like that stuff. If you do like things like Journey, if you do like any of those, I guess, sort of slightly more low interaction. I mean, there's interaction. There's more than probably Journey. But still, it's very slight on a mechanical level, but it's got a lot going on in terms of its context and its story, and certainly its atmosphere.
It sounds lovely.
It's. I think you might like it. You like chill, don't you?
I do.
Yeah. We could all do with a bit more chill and a bit less evisceration sometimes. Don't get me wrong, I love Doom. I love the Doom. But, you know, there is this other side that I also enjoy a lot. In a similar sort of tangent to this, like, I've been playing a lot of VR. I've been playing a lot of Elite. And that is the most chill thing in the world, and I love it. I'm having so much fun doing menial delivery tasks in that game because it's got such a sense of place with the VR. I really feel like I'm there and just flying my ship around doing, fulfilling some tasks. And it's just nice being there. It's not like I'm being attacked every 5 seconds or anything like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes that is a good thing. That's something that games can offer in a way that other media does as well, but not to the same degree, I don't think, in terms of immersion. So, Stillness of the Wind, definitely not for everybody, but watch the video, you'll see what you're in for, give it a look, I'd recommend it.
On a complete tangent, because it's reminded me of a game that I absolutely love the idea of, but have never played.
Okay.
It reminds me of a PC game called The Graveyard. I don't know if you know this one. I think it's by Tale of Tales, who used to do loads of like really experimental narrative stuff.
Okay.
And basically, you're an old woman walking around a graveyard, and you can sit on a bench and listen to a record, and that's about it. Right. All you can really do is walk around and then listen to this record. And the demo version of it allows you to do this for an infinite amount of time. You can just do it whenever you want. If you pay money for it, then at random points while you're playing, your character will just die. And like that's the one thing that you pay for to have the full experience, is that your character will eventually die in this graveyard.
The Mortality DLC.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
I always thought that was like a really brilliant selling point of a game. Like, oh, you can play this game as much as you want, but you can't die unless you buy it. It's like just what a really weird way of selling something.
I'm looking at it on Steam at the moment. Mixed reviews, let's say, not unsurprisingly. But it's funny that the more like this games are exactly the kind of games that we're talking about here. So games like What Remains of Edith Finch, Shelter, games like Tacoma, which I've recently played through and really like.
Oh, what a game.
Yeah, so stuff like that. If you're into that kind of thing, then this one might be for you. But if you want to shoot the man dead, then give the Stillness of the Wind a body's worth. What else are you doing Switch-wise before we go?
I mean, if you want to shoot a man dead, you could play City of Brass.
Ooh, okay, what's that about?
Which is another roguelike, another first-person roguelike, from, I think, some ex-Bioshock developers.
Okay.
I don't really know the background of it too well. But basically, so it's a Arabian Nights-inspired roguelike. You run through a desert city, which has been abandoned, save for loads of skeletons and traps that all want you dead. And you've got a sword, so there's no guns or anything, but you can like slice up your enemies. And more interestingly, you have a whip. And the whip is amazing. It's probably the best first-person shooter innovation I've seen in a long time. Your whip is used mainly to sort of grab things from afar. So there's loads of treasure lying around, you're supposed to run over and pick it up. But with the whip, you can just whoosh, and just pick it up straight away. When you're facing enemies, they have like locational damage. So if you hit them in the head with the whip, it stuns them. If you hit them in the arm, it disarms them. And if you hit them in the legs, then it just trips them up.
Gotcha.
And then you can use it as well to disarm traps. So if you walk through a door, there's usually a trap directly in front of a door when you walk through it. So you have to look down, whip it, it'll trigger the trap, and then you just walk over it while it's triggered, so you're not taking damage. Okay. And then sometimes there's little hooks in the ceilings as well. It's all procedurally generated, so like you never know what the layout's going to be like, but sometimes you'll look up, you'll see a hook, you can whip that hook, and you'll just fly across the stage. And you can also use it to like grab things and pull them toward, like grab enemies as well, and pull them towards you, or pull them into traps, which is great. Like, the whip is amazing.
I feel like there was something a bit whip-like in Bulletstorm.
Yeah, that was like an electro whip kind of thing.
Yeah.
But that had a different effect. That was like, it pulled people into the sky and slammed them down and put them in slow-mo and stuff like that.
But you're right, the idea of like something which is a ranged weapon but is also tethered to you, that's quite fun, especially when you can hookshot with it and all that.
Yeah, and you can, like, the grabbing items and stuff, like, it becomes a point where you think, oh, I could run over there and grab it. Nah, you just use your whip instead. Yeah. And I really like that. The rest of the game, I don't like. I think... I know roguelikes are supposed to be hard. This is so, so hard. Like, from the beginning. So, every level you go into has a time limit, which is kind of okay, but also is the biggest pain in the ass in the world. Because you're always just kind of being encouraged to just keep running, keep going forwards. But there's loads of enemies in the way. You will always forget that there's traps coming up. So you'll immediately just run into a spike trap and lose a heart. And you've only got like 3 or 4 to start with. So not exactly ideal to be instantly losing health. And it is like stupid stuff where it's like, oh, you open a door, there's a trap directly in front of you. You just walk into it because you're going, oh, I've only got so much time left on the limit. And you just go, dead. Like, oh, great, thanks.
Oh, right.
And the number of enemies that you like are thrown into the map as well is just inordinate. It's ridiculous how much you have to deal with when you first start the game. There's no kind of difficulty curve, it's just hard. And you can put on modifiers to make the game easier. And the only sort of disadvantage of that is that you're not allowed on the leaderboards. Like, any times and scores you post on the leaderboards won't be counted because you've got these modifiers on to make the game easier for yourself. But it sort of feels like cheating as well. Because, you know, it's not like, you know, I'm not playing the game as it's intended to be played.
Yeah.
And if you are playing the game as it's intended to be played, you have to spend a lot of time getting used to just how tough it is.
This is really interesting because I have a quick peek at reviews and videos and stuff when it's something I haven't played before.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting everything from like 7/8 to 3/4 out of 10 on this.
Oh,
and the phrase maddeningly difficult is popping up a bunch.
Well, that's good. I often particularly with difficulty, I'm often like, oh, maybe I'm just not good at the game, and it's a horrible
feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's nice to know that other people agree with me, so that makes it feel a lot better. But yeah, it just needs a bit of balancing. It's interesting, it's got some neat ideas, it's got the whip. I think it's worth it for the whip alone. I really love the whip. As I said in my review title, it needs whipping into shape.
Oh,
hey. I was proud of that one.
Punishment. Okay, that's City of Brass. That's over there on the Switch. Other mobile review, not review really, but other mobile game that's out this week of note is, I was going to say, The Horns is out, which is an interactive horror novel thing. It's like a digital game book. Haven't played it, so couldn't say anything about that. But the other one is Revolve 8, which is Sega's feudal attempt at a Clash Royale style game. So I've only played a little bit of this, but the idea is Clash Royale format. It's going left to right instead of top to bottom of the screen, and you are taking control of a bunch of extremely anime feudal style warriors, but they also seem to include like fictional fairy tale characters. Like, you get introduced to like Red Riding Hood comes skipping onto the screen at one point, which is a bit weird. But it's exactly the same principle. Energy bar charging at the bottom, a collection of cards which you can drag onto the screen, 2 smaller towers and a main king tower. You know, it is 100% that. But it's set against the backdrop of a, you know, falling blossom that you get from Japan. And it works. The animation's very nice. Little 3D characters bopping around. I haven't played it enough to see whether it has, like, longevity or anything. But all the beats are just pretty much one for one, you know, Clash Royale. Like, you know exactly how to play this the moment you pick it up.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anything that's appeared that makes it different. It's like right down to the fact that, you know, you can only drop your troops within the first half of the map. You know, the moment you pull onto the screen, it indicates with a yellow crosshatch, you can only put them here. And, you know, some Clash Royale style games just let the characters automatically start from the back and just continue to walk forward. Or sometimes you can choose where you want the characters to go. They'll introduce these extra little additions or changes to the gameplay. So far, none of that. This is just Clash Royale, only it's turned it on its side.
And made it anime.
Well, yeah, but I mean, nothing wrong with that. If you want that, the visual style of it. I mean, and again, there might be more that happens later that I haven't got to yet. But just at first blush, it is that thing that we've known for quite a while now. So Revolve 8 with the figure 8, all one word. That's the name of that one. That's from Sega, and that's free download on all the platforms. I do think I mentioned Riot Civil Unrest.
Yes, that was a Switch game.
That was a Switchy one. Did you have a peek at that?
I did. I didn't write a review of it because I don't think you can put a score on this one because it's really, really weird. So it's a pixel art strategy game sort of thing, real-time strategy. Mm-hmm. And you are playing either as the rioters or the police in real-life riot situations. So stuff like the Arab Spring is one of the things that they include in the game. So you can play as the rioters, and you can do things either peacefully or you can start being aggressive when you need to. I like to play peacefully. I'm generally a nice, non-aggressive person, so you can choose to sort of put people in certain... But you have, like, four groups that you control, and you put them in certain places, and then you can tell them to raise their arms, which improves their ability to stand in one place. Then you can make them sit down. You can just sort of blockade areas where you don't want the police to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then if things need to turn violent, you can start throwing rocks at the police. You've got, like, the police will start firing smoke grenades into the thing, so you've got to like use an anti-smoke grenade canisters, which will help keep your groups from running away. And you can also like shout and cheer and stuff like that to help reduce anxiety and stop people from breaking away and running away from the thing. And then you can play as the police and you can do the opposite and start firing rubber bullets at them from shotguns and shooting gas canisters and charging into them with shields and brutally attacking people. And you can again try and do it peacefully, but the temptation is there, and you will almost instantly go, ah, this would be way easier if I just started shooting at people. And so you do. And then it's like, oh God, this is really what happens.
And I'm guessing that that's what the game is going for. Well, is it, do you think it's trying to be deliberately just like controversial and pointlessly violent? Is it a murder sim? Or do you think it is genuinely trying to make you feel that weird tension?
I think it's definitely trying to give you that real world feeling. It's not like a murder sim. It's a very small development team. They said they've tried to take it from both angles, but there's obviously a kind of slant towards the people, the rioters.
Sure.
And it's based on their own experiences at some protests in Italy against like a high speed rail network. That's one of the scenarios that you can play through as well. And it's kind of based on their own experiences of being part of the protest groups and experiencing it firsthand. So it is definitely a reflection of reality. And it is, in its own way, trying to give you an understanding of both sides of the story, I guess. But it just doesn't feel right to not be a rioter, I guess. Maybe that's just me being a bleeding heart liberal.
Sure.
As I believe the phrase is. But it just makes me really deeply not happy to play. It's too close to reality. Can abstract it as much as you want with pixel art and stuff like that, but this is a fact. These are people who were brutally attacked by police officers because that's what their job was to do, and that kind of thing. And it's just like, And is it a good game? Not particularly, because it's quite slow. Your main goals is usually to sort of guard an area for 5 minutes, and if you're a protest group, that mostly just revolves around sitting in a spot for 5 minutes and hoping the police don't start like shooting at you. But I think it's interesting and important, and I'm probably going to remember the feeling of ickiness that stuck with me.
Awesome. Okay, then. Well, that's Riot Civil Unrest. It's also available on Steam if you wanted to get it, but it is currently out on the Switch if you want to feel bad, weird. I don't know. Any of those things. All right. I think we're just hitting the hour mark on this recording now. This has been a Esoteric Chatcast 2019. I hope you're still with us. Thank you for listening. We have a sleepy one this week, but we will be back again next week with more gaming chat and hopefully a lot more new releases on mobile. Go and download something cool. We will see you next time. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.